Funding for Think is made possible by SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What social and economic factors play into women's choices about work over the course of their lives, and how do their attitudes and choices change once they become parents? Conventional wisdom suggests that opting out of the labor force is a luxury chosen mostly by women of middle-class means or above, while working-class women have no choice but to keep their jobs while they raise families. But as my guest today will explain, the real story is far more nuanced and suggests that women's decisions to work after kids involve a lot more than financial calculations. Sarah Damaschke is Assistant Professor of Labor Studies and Employment Relations at Pennsylvania State University, and she's a regular contributor to the Huffington Post. Her new book is called For the Family: How Class and Gender Shape Women's Work. Sarah, welcome to Think.
Thanks so much for having me.
Just to get this out of the way, we'll stipulate here that during this discussion, when we talk about women working, we mean in jobs outside the home. That is in no way to disregard the amount of work done by stay-at-home moms for their families and their communities. It's just for expediency in this conversation. So, Sarah, why is there so much misunderstanding about the choices women make regarding their participation in the workforce?
Well, I think that's a really great question. It's one that I was really puzzled by when I started this research, because it's very common for people to say that working class women need to work and that middle class women can choose whether or not to work. And so when I went out and I started interviewing women, I found that, in fact, women do say that they need to work. But the interesting thing is that they say that they need to work regardless of of their family's financial situation. And so middle-class women who work say that they make their work decisions for their families because their families need them to. And working-class women who work say that they, too, remain employed to benefit their families financially. And so it's actually true that almost everyone who works says that they're doing so for their family's financial benefit, regardless of kind of what their family's financial situation are or kind of the other decisions that went into their factors that went into their decision.
And underlying this, I guess, is a really widespread assumption that if women don't absolutely need the money and they choose to work, they must not care very much about their kids.
Yeah, I think it's really a concern that women have. And women that I interviewed told me over and over again that they were concerned that they would be perceived as selfish. And I think that it's very common for women to worry either if they are working or if they're not working, that someone else is looking at them and saying, oh, you made the wrong decision. You're not doing what's best for your family. And so I think that saying I'm making the decision I make for my family gives women a little bit of protected space that allows them to kind of stake out a claim and say, you know, I'm doing what's kind of morally acceptable. And it allows them to kind of de-emphasize aspects of their decision-making that they feel less comfortable with.
Another assumption that we tend to make is that the most of the women who opt out of the workforce and to stay home must be women who had these high-power jobs that have partners who make enough money that they can live at home. You actually, stay at home rather, you actually didn't find that to be the case.
No, in fact, I find, and national studies have found, quite the opposite. If we look at women by income level, for example, as women's income level, family incomes rise, so too does their workforce participation. And in fact, if we look by education level, 85% of women with graduate degrees are employed, compared to 80% of those with college degrees, 68% with high school degrees, and only 48% of those with less than a high school degree. So it's really strikingly obvious when you look kind of nationally or within my study sample that you see that working class women are much less likely to remain steadily employed than middle class women are.
Well, and one would imagine that some of that has to do with the cost of childcare. If you are working class and you can only make a couple dollars more per hour than you would pay out in childcare, the formula doesn't work.
Yes, yes. And so clearly part of the formula is the cost of childcare. And it's not just the cost of childcare, it's how women make strategies for childcare.
Mm-hmm.
And so for middle-class women, they're much more likely to use daycare centers. They're much more likely to pay for childcare. Whereas working-class women, because childcare is so expensive, they're much more likely to rely on friends and family members. And so there, I found that the working-class women that I interviewed often had sometimes 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 people caring for their kids in a given week. And the average was three caregivers, three separate caregivers in a given week. And so so another part of the calculation is that a job needs to be worth it. It needs to be worth the effort of organizing those three caregivers that you're kind of juggling and making sure that they are kind of there and able to care for your children. So you, a working class woman, wanted to be in jobs where they felt like they were being respected, where they felt they were being paid well, where they felt there could be opportunities to stay. And when they did, even when they were poorly paid, they stayed in those jobs. They made the extra effort to kind of keep juggling all of those kind of child care networks. But when jobs weren't worth it, it's really hard to keep the juggle up.
Mm-hmm. And sometimes women leave jobs because, at least in part, because the jobs are not so great, they're not very fulfilling, mm-hmm. but they almost never give this as the reason that they've chosen to stay home.
No. And so it's very interesting that the women that I interviewed were very reluctant when they were asked why. So why did you end up doing what you did? They said, oh, well, my family needed me to be at home. And I found it really surprising. For example, in the case of a woman I call Angela in the book, and she was a secretary and she had loved her job, and it got bought out and new management came in and they switched her from kind of working steadily for one person as their secretary to being a floater. And she told me that they started treating her like she was, quote, a dingbat who didn't know how to answer a phone.
Mm-hmm.
but then when I said, you know, so why did you leave? She said, oh, well, my family really needed me. My kids needed me to be at home. And so it kind of provides both this ability to kind of claim this moral ground, oh, I'm there for my kids when they need me, and also a way, I think, to buffer against the treatment that some of these women face at work, that they kind of, all these years of work experience doesn't matter anymore when they start having a new boss who treats them like a dingbat, and they can kind of push that to the side and focus on their family and on the reasons.
Yeah, well, the other challenge that you or the other stereotype that you challenge here is that women who are working class still want to feel like they're contributing and like work means something, as opposed to simply showing up and receiving a paycheck.
Exactly. And I think that's one of the things we've really been misunderstanding when we think about women's work, that we think, oh, well, even when I explain this, oh, well, of course, that makes sense. Middle-class jobs are better. That's why those women are staying. They like working more. But it's actually a little bit more complicated than that, because I talked to a woman who worked at Kmart who told me, you know what? People don't really acknowledge this, but working at Kmart is pretty challenging. You have customers who are testy. You have a boss who's testy.
Mm-hmm.
You have all these people that you have to juggle on a daily basis, and you have to maintain a pleasant expression. And you have to kind of get through the day, and you have to figure out how to help everyone else who's trying to make it through their day.
Mm-hmm.
And she really felt that there were skills that she employed in her job, and that no one else thought that she had those skills. And so that was really clear in my interviews, that women in working class jobs had these kinds of skills that just aren't acknowledged.
Can you talk about where you drew the line between working class and middle class? Because you describe some families in the book as middle class whose incomes are well into the six figures, which in at least in my mind, and I am not a demographic expert, sounds like above middle class.
Right. And so what I decided for the book is to just break everyone into two broad categories, working class or middle class. And I think we can obviously think that there could be distinctions within each group. But for the purpose of the book, I think it made sense to kind of draw the line in terms of education level. Mm-hmm. So people who were in jobs that required college degrees or above, I considered middle class. And people who were in jobs where they had that required less than a college degree were generally working class. And I think the reason to do it that way is that the difference, the decision making between someone who was making, say, 80,000 and into the six figures mm-hmm. was pretty similar.
Right.
It was a pretty similar process. And again, with the women who we can maybe draw out and call working poor versus working class, again, fairly similar decision making and having kind of more similar backgrounds in terms of when they are growing up too.
Sarah Damaschke is my guest. She's assistant professor of labor studies and employment relations at Pennsylvania State University. Her new book is called For the Family, How Class and Gender Shape Women's Work. If you'd like to join the conversation, talk about your experience, we'd love to hear from you at 1-800-933-5372. You can also send email to think@kera.org. Right now, we will take just a couple of minutes to remind you of the importance of our winter membership campaign. As we have told you, we are looking to raise all the money we need in half the time we spent last year on the winter membership campaign. Your quick action in terms of making a contribution now allows this to be possible. Our goal for this hour of Think is to raise a total of $2,200. Your contribution at any level will help us to get there. You can make a really significant contribution if, say, you become a Friends level member at $1,500. You can also make, honestly, you could do 5% of the total for the hour with a contribution of just $110. Hey, Jeff Whittington.
Hey, Chris Boyd. I want to thank Jacqueline Mackey, who joined the station. I want to thank Marsha Kleinheinz in Fort Worth and Mary Petter in Colleyville. We also heard and owe huge thanks to Maria Carrillo and Crum, Maureen and Larry Waldy in Dallas, Matthew and Carrie France in Dallas, and Barbara Cleave, who joined in Dallas. All these folks either clicked and joined online or they called 888-694-6931. It's a beautiful day out there. It's a beautiful winter day here in North Texas, and we're hoping that you will join us today and help us on our campaign, not just the fundraising campaign, but the campaign to raise all the money necessary in just half the time.
We do have lots of ways to say thank you. You can check those out online. They include copies of Sarah Damaschke's book, For the Family. And the reason I'm saying it strangely is there is a question mark at the end of that. For the Family, How Class and Gender Shape Women's Work. Really interesting piece of scholarship. And it is a somewhat scholarly book, but there are lots of stories of individuals. And it is something that you actually could sort of curl up with and enjoy reading and I think gain some interesting insights from. So if you would like to choose that as your thank you gift, just make your contribution at or above the $120 level today, and we would love to be able to send that to you.
888-694-6931. That's the phone number. It's toll-free. Quick and easy when you call. You'll talk to a friendly person on the other end at 888-694-6931. Or click and join at kera.org. Also convenient way to make your contribution. Safe and secure, of course, and you'll be in and out of the contribution interface in just a couple of minutes. As Chris mentioned, you can choose to receive your very own copy of Professor Damaschke's book when you join the station. And if you want to become a sustaining member and have us say thanks with a copy of the book, you can do that at the $10 a month contribution level. Sustaining membership is really easy to set up. You can do that online as well. And it's just a easy monthly affordable transfer from your account to KERA's account. And your membership is always current.
That's right. It's always current. And honestly, you may not even feel it coming out of your budget if it's just $10 or $20 or $30 or $50 a month. So think about your contribution. Please get in touch with us now. Send the message that you want a shorter fundraising campaign. Do that by going online now to kera.org, where you can sign up for a membership, renew your membership, and also check out thank you gifts. Or you can call in on the phone to 1-888-694-6931. We'll be back in just over 2 minutes with Sarah Damaschke.
Funding for Think is made possible by SMU Continuing and Professional Education. You can enrich your career with new certificate programs in web design, graphic design, and paralegal studies. Learn more at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Sarah Damaschke, Assistant Professor of Labor Studies and Employment Relations at Pennsylvania State University and a regular contributor to the Huffington Post. Her new book is called For the Family, How Class and Gender Shape Women's Work. Join our conversation by calling in to 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. Sarah, I was really interested to read how very influential our families of origin are and our growing up years are in terms of really setting the expectations that will govern our choices over a lifetime of work.
Yes, it was something that I was really interested in and surprised by when I interviewed the women that I spoke with. I found that when I was really struck by the fact that when I talked to middle-class women, I had a section in the interview schedule where I said, and what did you expect to do after you finished high school? Did you think you would go to college, or did you think you would do something else? And middle-class women women who grew up in middle-class families were puzzled. They were puzzled by the question. Mm-hmm. They couldn't imagine having thought that they wouldn't have gone to college, having thought that they wouldn't have then gone on to work. It was just so drilled into them, and this was women across all different races in the middle class. But women who grew up in working class families had a very different reaction to that question. White and Latino women described a struggle, described growing up in families where work wasn't necessarily what was anticipated for them, and described feeling like women who worked full-time were women who were really good in school, women who they had this image in their mind of a woman with a briefcase in one hand and a baby in the other. And she didn't look like them. Mm-hmm. And to them that meant, well, they had to think, could I be like her? Or is that not me? Is that some other woman? Mm. And African American women in working class families described growing up in a very different environment than that. They described growing up in communities where women worked. It was so accepted that their mothers had worked, that they would go on to work, that there was no other option, and that leaving the workforce at any point in time would not be possible. And so there are very different expectations depending on the households that women grew up in.
Yeah, the thing that I would have thought would have made a huge impact even on middle-class women was whether or not their mothers left the workforce or remained in the workforce after they were born. And that had a lot less to do with it than their level of educational attainment.
It did. It was interesting, and so I think we see really a transformation over the last 30 years, where women who grew up in middle class families, regardless of what their mothers did, some of them had mothers who stayed at home, some of them had mothers who worked, but they all expected to work. And I think that the thing to remember here is that sometimes we look at what our mothers did and think, oh, that's terrific. That's precisely what I want to do. And sometimes you look and say, oh, well, maybe that's not quite the path that I want. And that's the process that these women had. And especially for the women growing up in middle-class families, many of their mothers were saying to them, even if they themselves had stayed at home, were saying to them, this isn't the path for you. I want you to go and get an education and to plan to go into the workforce, which is a very, even if it was very different from what they themselves had done.
And women who grew up always with the expectation that they would work continuously throughout their adult lives, when they would come to, and everybody's had them, a job that was not fulfilling or didn't pay very well, or they had a layoff or something, rather than seeing that as sort of an opportunity to then pull back and go into the home full time, they said, well, this is a temporary setback.
Yes. And so it really gave them a framework with which to look at what was happening in their lives. And so when they ran into a bad job, they said, oh, well, I'll just go find a better job. They had this real confidence that a better job was around the corner, and that that having expected that they would work steadily, they were much more likely to then go and continue to work steadily and to search again and again for better options. Now, they didn't always find them, and sometimes they didn't always stay, but they were much more likely to look for multiple times for better jobs than were women who expected to only work occasionally.
So are there social consequences, Sarah, for women who, for whatever reason, defy the norms of their class or their race?
Sure. So I would say about half of the women who grew up in working class white and Latino homes ended up deciding to work steadily. And these women, in general, ended up better off than their counterparts who anticipated that they would work only occasionally. They either moved into middle class through education. They went on to college and then went into steady work, or they found more stable working class jobs than their counterparts who expected to work only occasionally did.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's speak first to Parul in Plano. Hi, Parul.
Hi, how are you doing?
Very well, thank you.
Very interesting program.
Thank you. Go right ahead, please.
So a little bit about myself. I am originally from India. I have a double master's, one in English and the other in radio, TV, and film. And I'm a freelance filmmaker, an actress, and a technical writer. And what I want for myself is to create my own opportunities, because a typical 9-to-6 job, I find that extremely boring. And then just to sit at home, because with a new baby coming in and already have a baby, it's really hard for me to even do that. So have you had a chance to interview people in this bracket? And, I mean, do you have any input from this particular range of, you know, experience?
Thanks for your call.
Hi, Parul. Thanks so much. It sounds really interesting. And I think I heard you say that you had a baby on the way. Congratulations. I think that one of the real needs in this country is for increased workforce flexibility. And it's something that I heard over and over again with the women that I interviewed. And women were much more likely to stay when they found jobs that had better hours. And it's a real need. And I think that when women found jobs where they were able to be more flexible, they were able to stay longer. And it's interesting because research has shown that actually jobs that we think about as traditionally feminine jobs tend to have less workplace flexibility than more traditionally masculine jobs. And so getting women into the kinds of jobs where they'll have more workplace flexibility is a really important step towards making work and family more possible for women.
We haven't talked about women who have partners who may be working. I mean, to what extent is the income, steady or not, of a partner an important factor in women's choices about staying at work or staying at home?
Well, it's an interesting question. And traditionally, the economic theory was that as a husband's income rose, a wife's participation levels would drop. And there is some research that suggests that there's a little bit of a correlation, but only at the very, very highest of income levels. And until then, it doesn't really matter. And what's happening at those very, very high levels is that you see that men are working 60-plus hours a week. And as we know, men and women are today more likely to marry people with similar education levels. And so their wives are actually often finding themselves in jobs where they're working 60-plus hours a week, too. And so it's when jobs are that demanding, when everybody's working 60-plus hours a week, that there's real conflict in terms of managing work and home.
I guess we also have, perhaps for good reasons, maybe for simple economics, we've let go of the stereotype that a man is only a good father if his wife does not have to work so that he can support the entire family.
I think we've let go of the idea that she shouldn't have to work. I'm less certain that we aren't still very closely committed to the idea that men need to be good providers. Mm-hmm. And it's something that I talk a lot about with my work-family classes. And it's something that some of my students last semester created this great presentation for the end of the semester, in which they suggested, you know, we should go into schools at a young age and start talking to kids about dads who are stay-at-home dads and dads who do more at home, because as we talked about in class, it can be very detrimental for men, this breadwinning responsibility and this idea that they have you know, that regardless of whatever kind of income the wife's bringing in, they have to still be earning a breadwinning role.
Let's go back to the phones now at 1-800-933-5372. We have Sarah on the line in Plano. Hi, Sarah.
Oh, hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
This is a very interesting topic to me. I have been at home 25 years. I stopped working as soon as I got pregnant with my first one. And I chose to stay home. And also, I don't fit into that middle class or working class. I actually don't have a college degree, but I learned a lot of the stuff on the job, and I was actually working right next to, right alongside other professionals, and I did a lot of accounting work.
Mm-hmm.
And the same people had gone to college and doing the same thing I was doing. And that happened also at other companies as well. So I think that you might be missing something there as far as different types of workers, because there are those that they do a lot of the professional work, except they're not degreed. They've learned it on the job like I did. Okay, and then another thing, there's also another reason why people stay home, and that's also because we're religious conservative, like Baptist. They really preach that you're really the best for the family, for the woman to stay home, to really be there for everything the child needs, and especially that Christian upbringing. And so there's another facet to this.
Absolutely, and I appreciate your call, Sarah. Sarah Damaski, we're about to take a quick break here, so I will, if you can hang on to your response until after the break, we will make sure and get it. My guest this hour is Sarah Damaski, who is Assistant Professor of Labor Studies and Employment Relations at Pennsylvania State University. She's also a frequent contributor to The Huffington Post. Her new book that we're discussing this hour is called For the Family, How Class and Gender Shape Women's Work. If you'd like to join in the conversation, we do have lines open at 1-800-933-5372. Or you can send your comments or questions via email to think@kera.org. If you'd like to receive a copy of Sarah Damaski's book, we do have it available at or above the $120 contribution level today. We are, of course, in our winter fundraising campaign when we ask you to come to us with your financial support to keep this programming on the air for North Texas, for you, for your family. We have started the goal this hour with $2,200 to raise. We have $1,630 remaining. Your contribution will make us will take us that much closer. It's not an enormous amount, but please don't leave it to other people. If you're ready to make a contribution, do it now. Send the signal that you want to keep these fundraising drives just as brief as absolutely possible. Senior producer of Think and host of Anything You Ever Wanted to Know, Jeff Whittington, is now here in the studio. Hello again, Jeff.
Hello, Chris. And yes, just to remind everyone listening, if you just joined us, what we're doing during this membership campaign, the winter membership campaign last year, was a 24-day campaign. We were successful, but it did take a little longer than any of us, you all and us included, want these drives to take. So we recognize that. We know that you want the drives to be more efficient, and so do we. And so that's why our goal this drive is to raise all the money necessary in half the time. That means cutting it in half. That means 12 days of fundraising. We're going to get there if we stay on track. And to stay on track this hour, we've got to raise another $1,630. Chris, we made the goal last hour, so thanks to everyone who's contributed so far. We'd love to be able to thank you when you call and support the station with a contribution at 1-888-694-6931. Again, that phone number is 888-694-6931. Or click and join online at kera.org if you're getting back from lunch. Maybe you're using this time to run in from the parking lot, from the car, so you don't miss any of the conversation with Professor Sarah Damaski. We're going to be back to that conversation shortly, so use this time right now to make your contribution.
It is an absolute joy and a privilege to bring you these conversations every day and to interact with you. So many of you call and write in. So many of you are simply listening, but listening very actively to the program. It is phenomenal to have an audience like you. It is also the reality that those of you in the audience who actually give a bit of your hard-earned money to this station make it possible. We couldn't do the show. Local shows are expensive. expensive. We couldn't do the show if we didn't have support from people who want this to be here. If this is part of your lunchtime routine, if anything you ever wanted to know is something that you plan your lunch around on Fridays, we would love to hear from you now at 1-888-694-6931 or online at kera.org.
We heard from Douglas and Rogine Howard in Dallas, Maria Sants in Corinth. We heard from Katarina Torres in Dallas and Margarita Benser in Farmers Branch. Thanks to each of you. Thank you so much for supporting the station. Emma Massey and Tyler, thanks to you. Thanks to Melina Pearson in Dallas. Hello, Melina. Thank you so much for your contribution. And Janine Bucker in Dallas. And Casey and Harold Montgomery, also in Dallas. Thank you so much to each of you for making your contribution. Folks, each one of those people called 888-694-6931, or they contributed at kera.org online. Just $1,630 left to raise to make our goal for Think today, to make both goals, to achieve both goals and stay on track to raising half the money. I'm sorry, all the money in half the time.
Half the money in twice the time.
It's half the money in a quarter of the time.
Perfect.
That's what we want to do.
Right.
Half the money in a quarter of the time, or all the money in half the time.
No on-air math, Jeff. This always leads us down a bad path.
One-third of the money. No, go ahead. Go ahead, Chris.
1-888-694-6931 is the telephone number. You can also go to kera.org. If you're enjoying this discussion in particular with Sarah Damaschke, we do have copies of her book, For the Family, How Class and Gender Shape Women's Work. We'd love to be able to send you one with a contribution at or above the $120 level. That, by the way, I think is the average amount of the gifts to this station, but we have plenty of people who give thousands of dollars a year or hundreds a month, and we have a fair number of people who say, look, I can do $50 right now, or I can do $25 or whatever, but I do care about the station. Your participation at whatever level makes sense to you really is useful, and you're not only getting a great subscription to great radio, but you're providing a service for your community. There aren't too many contributions you can make to charitable organizations, nonprofit organizations that serve not only you, but also the broader community, or vice versa. So think of this as a great opportunity.
It's radio on the honor system. And if you can afford to support the station at whatever level is right for you, if you can afford to give a financial contribution to the station at any level, and you use the service and you rely on it and you listen, then we hope that you'll make that decision to do the right thing and support your public radio station with a quick phone call to 1-888-694-6931 or click and join at kera.org.
Think about becoming a sustaining member of the station, and then we do these automatic transfers of whatever amount you say every month from your account to KERA's account. It allows you to break up a contribution to the station and allows us to count on your support every month, which is really important. Again, that number, 888-694-6931, or even easier, the website kera.org. Thanks.
Funding for Think is made possible by SMU Continuing and Professional Education. You can enrich your career with new certificate programs in web design, graphic design, and paralegal studies. Learn more at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Sarah Damaschke, Assistant Professor of Labor Studies and Employment Relations at Pennsylvania State University and author of the new book, For the Family, How Class and Gender Shape Women's Work. Join us at 1-800-933-5372, which is where we heard from Sarah online in the last segment. And Sarah Damaschke, our caller Sarah, brought up the fact that her religious tradition suggests that women, if possible, ought to stay home with their families. Was that a major issue for many of the women you spoke with?
It was not a major issue for many of the women I spoke to, but I did speak to some women who, for whom it was a concern and who stayed at home for that reason.
Mm-hmm.
And it is very clear to me that there continues to be a segment of the population for which that is very true and an important part of their identities. But it's interesting because long-term stay-at-home moms, like Sarah, appear to be a shrinking part of the population. I'm doing a new study with Dr. Adrian Freck at the University of Akron, and what we're finding is that it appears to be that less than 10% of moms these days stay at home till their kids are 12. And so still a sizable number of 1 in 10, but significantly less than 30 to 50 years ago. And so we're really seeing a change in how women approach work and family these days.
What do you think we should make of the fact that even women who certainly were happy to be with their children and value that part of their lives, but had also left, apparently to anyone else, had also left because their jobs were not satisfying? Why is it so hard to say that out loud?
I think that I think for a couple of reasons. I think that one, that people tend to think work should be satisfying. It was interesting to me how many women who'd had so many disappointing work experiences kept thinking that there would be something better around the corner.
Mm-hmm.
And when there isn't, it can seem like a personal fault.
Yeah.
And I think that is actually pretty evident in some of our national conversation these days, this idea that if work isn't going well or if you lose your job, you're somehow personally responsible for that, that there's something you're doing wrong as opposed to the way the economy has constricted. And I think that women feel that, have that experience too, and they don't want to admit failures at work because it does seem like a personal failure rather than a failure due to the way the system's set up and the lack of pay and the lack of respect that they're finding there.
And then on the other side of things, it is very hard for many women. I suppose I'm an exception to this, to say I have my kids, I love them, but boy, I love my job. That somehow is thought to be very selfish.
Yes, I think it can sound a little selfish. And I think that women who say that are often say that to their friends, and I think that it's an interesting there's some interesting conflict where there's this ideal that we see kind of in the magazines when we kind of open up and read about some kind of famous actress having a baby and jet setting around the world and kind of everything is perfect. Having a baby is perfect. It's always like, it's always lovely. It's always fun. It's always joyful. And then there's really no recognition of, well, you know, sometimes it's not joyful. Sometimes it's tough. Sometimes it's really hard. And sometimes the baby won't sleep.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes it feels like a break to go back to work. And I think it can be really hard for women to admit that. And I think that it really is something that we should start encouraging women to say, that to acknowledge that raising kids is something that's both wonderful and challenging. and that it would be, I think, a better for our national dialogue to start there than to have these kind of just such a rose-colored glasses on all the time.
I know your book was not about the women's relationships with their children specifically, but I'm curious about what, even in offhand conversations, these women said to their children about their feelings about work. I mean, it's no secret to my children that I love work, but that I try to make them a priority to the extent that it's possible to get everything done. There are some people who feel like they can't tell their kids they're happy to go to work because that would make their kids feel bad.
Yes, and it was certainly something that women felt conflicted about, and that they felt like it was important to emphasize the benefits to their kids, so that their kids knew that they were working, that their working was beneficial to them, to the kids, and not just to the moms. But some women certainly were able to say, you know, this is good for me. And actually, I had a few exceptions to the rule who said, you know, I say to my daughter, I love my job because I want her to be able to grow up and love her job and know that it's okay for her to say that, know that it's good for her to say that.
Let's go back to the phones now. This time we have Brad on the line in Flower Mound. Hi, Brad.
Hi, Chris. Thanks so much. Hi, Sarah. My question kind of piggybacks on something that you mentioned a moment ago, and that is kind of in this culture of I can have it all mentality. Were there any findings that kind of determined perhaps past or post career time frame what their sense of self worth was and what their sense of overall joy was? And I ask that because in your 20s, you tend to be just kind of trying to figure out life, and you're very hungry to be successful, male or female. And I think sometimes when you reach your 40s and 50s and certainly 60s, what you wanted in your 20s from a career is certainly not the same thing. So I was just wondering if you had a sense of any feedback from those folks in terms of if they were any happier because they did one thing versus another, and I'll take my answer off air.
Thanks for your call.
Hi, Brad. Thanks so much. That's a really interesting question, and I actually I start the conclusion of the book asking about it's called the end of the book is called that last chapter is called Having It All, and it does say, you know, do they feel like they have it all? Do they feel happy with the choices that they've made? And the answer is a bit complicated. I think that few of them felt like they truly had it all, but I think a lot of them felt happy with their choices. I think the women who worked steadily in general reported being the most secure. They reported being having the most work-family conflict, but they also reported being the most financially and emotionally secure. They didn't worry about whether kind of life would kind of throw them a wrinkle that they couldn't handle. Whereas the women who followed what I call interrupted pathways, who had multiple bouts of unemployment, reported, as you might imagine, someone who faced that sort of situation would feel the least secure and the least happy with the options that were in front of them. And most of them kind of talked about kind of creating a path for their kids that would be better than the paths that they had, so that their kids, both male and female, could have work and family in balance and have both.
Is any of this getting easier for the dads out there who, I suppose every man, regardless of social status in our society, with very few exceptions, will expect to work continuously throughout his lifetime?
Yes, yes, that's true. And I think that dads are actually doing more than they used to at home. They've certainly increased their child care and household tasks in the last 30 years. So in some ways, it's actually a little trickier for them than it used to be, because they too now have these dual roles where they have to go out and work and they have to be at home. But I think that for everyone, when they're partnered with someone who shares their expectations and who is helping out too, it eases the burden and it makes it more possible for everyone to kind of reach the goals that they have set out for themselves.
Have we actually made significant strides toward more flexible work schedules for parents in general, single or married or coupled up?
We have. There has been, I think, quite a bit of increased flexibility in the workplace in recent years, but I think it's not nearly enough. And I think that what we're starting to see now is that that we're starting to realize that it's that it's not just about kind of changing attitudes about women's desire to work or their participation in the workforce. It's pretty clear that that's a trend that's here to stay. But it's about kind of thinking about how do we change institutions so that they recognize, well, it's not, because most institutions are set up based on a system that worked 50 years ago, in which there was one person who worked and one person who stayed at home. Well, hardly any families look like that anymore. So how do institutions respond to the new family forms?
Sarah Damaschke is Assistant Professor of Labor Studies and Employment Relations at Pennsylvania State University and a regular contributor to the Huffington Post. Her new book is called For the Family, How Class and Gender Shape Women's Work. Sarah, thank you so much for spending this hour with us.
Thanks so much for having me. I really enjoyed it.
You can receive a copy of Sarah Damaschke's new book, For the Family, if you make a contribution now at the level of $120 or above. You can do that by going online to kera.org and clicking through to the support page, or you can give us a phone call at 1-888-694-6931. $839 left to raise in this hour in order to make the goal for our second hour of Think Today. That is now down to $700. $1,979. Looks like a nice $60 contribution there. An additional number of $60, $120 contributions would make it happen. Perhaps you are in a place where you can swoop in and get the entire hour for the rest, the entire amount for the rest of the hour. Whatever amount you can contribute, please do it now so that we can keep this short drive short at KERA.org and 1-888-694-6931. Jeff Whittington is back. He, of course, is senior producer of Think and also the host of Anything You Ever Wanted to Know on Fridays. Welcome back, Jeff.
Thank you very much, Chris. What a great conversation. We got lots of great calls. It's really great to see everybody participating in the show on really what's the first full weekday of the membership campaign this winter. And as we've been saying the whole weekend, our goal is not just to get your participation, but to get your participation to help us and to help everyone else contribute and raise all the money in half the time. Half the time compared to last winter. And last winter's membership campaign in January, it was 24 days. It took 24 days to get to our overall goal. We don't want to do that again. We want to do it in 12 days, and we're well on track to doing that thanks to folks like Stephen Maines and Farmers Branch, who's a regular emailer.
Yes, we hear from him all the time. Always great observations.
Yeah. So thanks so much, Steve, for your contribution. We heard from Chris Henley in Keller. Thank you, Chris. We heard from Virginia Green in Wichita Falls. Thank you so much to each of you. We'd love to see your name come across our screen here. We'd love to hear the phone ring when you call 888-694-6931. We'd love to see your virtual, your electrons come across the screen from your click and join activities at KERA.org.
You can choose from a variety of thank you gifts. Of course, we have copies of Sarah Damasky's book, For the Family. We have the book from Last Hour, Queen of America, the novel by Luis Alberto Urrea, and a number of other gifts as well. So if somehow you would love to make $120 or a $240 or maybe you want to make a friends-level contribution and think, but I would like a little thank you gift. There are plenty of great options depending on what you want to do. There's also the option to decline a thank you gift, and then we will take the entire amount of your contribution. And rather than spending a little bit of it on a thank you gift, we will put it all to work on programming.
Hey, it's okay to take a thank you gift.
It is okay.
Because you don't want to, you know, you don't want to get months down the road and go, I really should have gotten that thank you gift. Which has happened. Someone told me this weekend about, you know, they said, I didn't take a gift and now I really want a gift. So, you know, don't put yourself in that position. And Chris, you mentioned the friends level. We did hear from someone last hour at the friends level.
Oh, thank you for that.
So thank you very much. That's a $1,500 contribution. You can break that out as a sustaining friend of the station to just $125 a month when you join as a sustainer at the friends level. And you can choose a gift. You can choose the books from this hour and last hour. You can choose to receive 7,500 American Airlines Advantage miles when you become a friend of the station. And the friends membership comes with some other perks as well. You get invited to station events. You get to meet NPR personalities when they come through, and we have get-togethers for the friends group. And you know you're doing your part to make sure that this programming and these kinds of interviews are still here for you, for your friends and family, and for your neighbors.
Everybody that you are hearing us thank this hour, everybody who is making a contribution was once like you, perhaps, and had not yet made a contribution or had allowed several years to pass by. Join us now. Become a supporting member of the station, and you really will feel this sense of being part of the team that makes public radio possible. Thank you so much, Todd and Tanya Ramsey in Dallas. Thank you, Jeremy Larson in Dallas and Lynette Sullivan in Holly Lake Ranch. Thank you, Holly McKinney in Plano. And thank you if you are ready to go online right now at KERA.org or call 1-888-694-6931. Started the hour with a goal of $2,200 at last check.
We got an update right now.
Okay, where are we, Jeff?
We were at $779 left to raise, and we just got an update, $659 left to raise. During this hour, I think we've got about 3 minutes left. We made the goal in the first hour. Please help us if you have not yet contributed or if you can make an additional gift right now. Please help us make the goal in this hour. Help us stay on track to raising all the money in half the time. That means that you get 12 days back of the Think and Anything You Ever Wanted to Know programming, the shows that you are produced right here for you in North Texas, the shows that Chris and I work on. You get 12 days back without fundraising interruption. That's a great deal, and it's all you have to do is make the decision to go ahead and make your gift now rather than later in the drive.
Think of all the ways throughout the rest of your life that you sometimes decide to spend a little money in service to your time, to getting back a little time. That's exactly what we're doing here. We know that so many of you are planning at some point to make a contribution. We're just asking you to speed up the timetable, and you'll benefit from it as much as anybody else. So we would love to hear from you now. $659 left to raise in a little under a minute. However, if we had one person with a sustaining member at $50 a month, we could absolutely take care of that. Or a whole bunch of people at, you know, $60 or $120 or $240 would also take care of that. But please don't let this hour run out without keeping us on track to end the drive when we want to.
Phone number is 888-694-6931. 1-888-694-6931. Please call now or go online to KERA.org. Down to just $539 left to raise in the next, we've got about a minute and 10 seconds before we go to NPR News headlines. So please don't wait. Please do your part right now.
1-888-694-6931 is the telephone number. If you make your contribution online at KERA.org, you can check out thank you gifts and ways to pay, and you can set up that sustaining membership, a great affordable way for so many of you now to make contributions. Or if it's easier for you, you can, of course, use a credit or debit card and take care of it that way. Your support is important to this station. We do put your money to work. You hear it every single day of the year in the programming that you value on KERA. So please let us know that you want a shorter drive, that you want KERA to be strong and healthy. Go online to KERA.org or call us at 1-888-694-6931. Today's show was engineered by Shelley Canavy. Joe Pilotti answers the phones. Christine McConnell produces the podcast. Senior producer is Jeff Whittington. Learn more about Think, find out about upcoming programs, and of course, support the station at KERA.org. Once again, I am Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.